In the vicinity to come on in and join us. Bring in a coffee if you want from out there. We will have lunch starting at 11:45, and that will be part of the program for those who are participating here in the room. So again, welcome to the DNSSEC workshop, and we'll start momentarily. Welcome, everyone, again to the DNSSEC workshop. We're going to get started on our next panel discussion, which is experiences, challenges, and outcomes of DNSSEC deployment. I'd like to take a moment to introduce our moderator and our speakers, and then I will turn it over to the moderator. Our moderator for this is Russ Mundy, the co-chair of the DNSSEC Deployment Initiative. Our speakers are Kanzanori Fujiwara from JPRS, Vincent Lavigneron from NIC.fr, Peter Loescher from Internet Systems Corporation Consortium, pardon me, and joining us via video is Roland van Rijswijk from SurfNet. So without further ado, I'll turn things over to Russ Mundy.
Well, this is a great opportunity for us to hear from folks that have actually gone forth to do DNSSEC things in the real world and are willing to share some of their experiences. And we're very pleased to have our set of folks. We encourage questions and interactions. We're going to go through the presentations and then have a question period at the end. So let's go ahead and get started with our first presentation from Japan.
Hello. This is Kazunori Fujiwara from JPRS. I will talk about DNSSEC deployment in JP. Next slide, please. This is today's content. Japanese background, what we did, technical evaluation, DNSSEC introduction process. Japanese background, deploying new technology requires documents written in their own language, but most of DNSSEC materials are in English, and there are thousands of ISPs and hundreds of JP registrars in Japan. They offer various DNS services. Their cooperation is required for successful DNSSEC deployment, but hard to contact and conduct all of them. Next slide, please. What we did? We did enough announcement, technical explanation documents in Japanese, rollout schedule, DNSSEC parameters, JPDPS, DNSSEC practice statement. And we did enough technical evaluation with ISPs, vendors, JP registrars. They did their evaluations for their works. Next slide, please. Technical evaluation. We did two activities, technical evaluation by JPRS and participants, conducted by JPRS and DNSSEC Japan, a community initiative. JPRS is a member of DNSSEC Japan. Next. Technical evaluation by JPRS. JPRS did DNSSEC technical evaluation with some participants before implementing DNSSEC in JPTLD. November 2009 to November 2010. Purpose to collect, share, and publish DNSSEC operational practices. And major ISPs, hardware vendors, and JP registrars will implement DNSSEC easily. What was done? JPS called for participation in technical evaluation activity to some major ISPs, hardware vendors, and JP registrars. JPS offered DNSSEC testbed. JPS conducted monthly information exchange meeting among participants. DNSSEC technical evaluation by JPS. There are six steps. In step 1-2, November 29 to February last year, JPRS and JPDNS operators did fundamental function test and behavior check of zone transfer. In step 3-4, March last year to June last year, ISPs and hardware vendors joined. We did behavior and load check of full resolver variator DNS servers and behavior check of network devices. And we listed check items of ISPs hardware vendors. In step 5, July last year to November last year, JP registrars joined. We did behavior check of DS delegation and accumulation of operational experiences. And we also tested domain name transfer. And then, in step 6, we did joint evaluation with DNSSEC Japan. This is evaluation environment. JPS offered prepared should root, should JPDNS, should registrant DNS, and should registry system. And JP secondary offered should JPDNS. ISPs and vendors prepared network devices, should full resolver validator server, and load generators. They tested name resolution test and performance measurement, and the traffic came to should root, should JPDNS, should registrant DNS server, and JP registrars prepared should registrar system, should DNS hosting, should validator. They used should register system. Next. Result of technical evaluation. Participants and JPS had published 4 documents. DNSSEC function check instruction, DNSSEC performance check instruction, DNSSEC technical evaluation report, function and performance check action, and operation design action. Reports are published in JPS web page, but Japanese language only. English translation is ongoing. Participants and JPS made DNSSEC presentations at local meetings, Japan Network Operators Group meeting, July last year, Internet Week, November last year. Now many stakeholders started or are planning DNSSEC service. DNSSEC Japan, a community initiative. DNSSEC Japan was formed at November 24, 2009. DNSSEC Japan is a forum for domain name registries, registrars, registrants, and relevant parties such as DNS and network operators. With the aim of introducing and deploying DNSSEC, DNSSEC Japan's objectives are to sort out and discuss issues in relation to deployment and operation of DNSSEC, to enhance technical capability of participants and sharing of technical expertise, to conduct outreach activities such as providing relevant tools and giving technical commentaries. Result of DNSSEC Japan. DNSSEC Japan published DNSSEC documents in Japanese. and DNSSEC Japan held DNSSEC Forum meeting twice. And members are well learned DNSSEC. And member organizations are 36, and web page is here, but in Japanese language only. This is DNSSEC introduction process in .jp. July 9, 2009, JPS made first announcement. DNSSEC introduction schedule. Target was by the end of 2010. Then November 24, 2009, DNSSEC Japan was formed. December 1, 2009, technical evaluation by JPRS started. July 21, last year, JPRS made schedule announcement, month of signing on DS registration. And August 30, last year, JPRS published DNSSEC parameters for JP zone. September 6, last year, JPRS made announcement, date of signing on DS registration. And September 29, last year, JPDNS servers and JP registry system came to DNSSEC ready. And October 17 last year, JPL started signing of JP zone. November 30 last year, technical evaluation finished. December 10 last year, JPDS was registered in root zone. January 14 this year, JPS published JPDPS. January 16 this year, DNSSEC service rolled out. JPS started DS registration. And May 27, DNS and DNSSEC book was published in Japanese language. And currently, 20 registrars registered about 300 DS in JP domain name. This is a DNS book, Jissen DNS. Jissen DNS means practice DNS. Newly published on this May, authored by JPS employees. It explains daily DNS operations with DNSSEC. Conclusion. Documents written in own language are important. Joint evaluation with stakeholders is important. They become DNSSEC experts in their companies.
That's great. Thank you. And it makes an obvious point of the importance of language, because if it's not in language that you can use, then it's and you readily grasp, it makes it hard to handle. Okay, so let's move on to what I'll call the French experience.
Thank you. My name is Vincent Vignon, and I work for the French NIC, registry of some CCDLDs. Next, please. Okay, this is the plan of my presentation, not very interesting, but it will be interesting when you will download the full presentation. Next, please. AFNIC is a registry, and it operates six CCTLDs. This is a list of the CCTLDs, FR, RE, PM, TF, WF, and YT. Each of the zone is signed. And DNSSEC was introduced in September 2010. And for each zone, we roll over keys, zone signing keys, every 2 months. And we have chosen to use NSSEC 3 and opt-out options for these zones. Amongst these zones, FR zone is the largest one, with more than 2 million domain names. It's not a very big zone, but it's a middle-sized zone. And the zone contains about 4 million and a half resource records. But amongst these resource records, we have very few DS records. Registration of DS has been launched less than 2 months for FR and RE. So for the moment, there are not a lot of customers that want to sign their zones, it seems. Next, please. We also use OpenDNSSEC, but it's only used for key management. We don't use the full capabilities of OpenDNSSEC. For key storage, we use AEP Keeper HSMs, but all the signature stuff is done by bind, and we use AutoDNSSEC low option. Of course, all the math is done in the HSM, but bind control this. When we started DNSSEC, we used the version 9.7.1, but now we had to change, and we deploy the 9.7.3 version after the second outage we had. We also use OMET synchronization script to create bind key files that are understood by bind from OpenDNSSEC data. This is not the same version of key files. Next, please. While there are more than 4 million records under FR zone, there are less than 100 NSEC3 records and very few signatures. We have at the same time two KSKs. One is just published and the other one is active. At the time, we have between two or three zone signing keys. One is published, ready to be used. One is active and used to sign records. If we are just after a key rollover, the old active key is still published while inactive. We dynamic update our zones. It's the dynamically updated every hour, and once a week there is a complete zone file generation, but it's mainly for administrative purposes. We use dynamic updates only for delegation, not for all records. We use dynamic updates for NS, A, Quad A, and DS records. And all key and signature stuff is based on automatic signing bind capabilities. We don't use dynamic update in this case. Next slide, please. We have chosen to use a very large timing when we are under a key deletion process. When a key becomes inactive, it is deleted only 1 month later. That's why when you query .fr zone, you often notice that there are more than two zone signing keys at a time during a key rollover. When a key is deleted, we purge key files 3 days later. It was just 1 hour during the first outage we had in last November, but it has been increased after that event. What happened is when a key is about to be deleted, we are sure there are no signatures left corresponding to this key. Next, please. In fact, we had three big problems, not that big, because people don't really use DNSSEC at the moment, unfortunately. But the problem is that outages were visible, so it's not very good for us. And during key deletion, we had a network issue making our HSM unreachable. But the error was not well detected, so the publication process didn't stop. It should stop, but it didn't stop as expected. And the zone was not updated as expected. Enki with a delayed state was still present while it was inactive. Our homemade script, which is an open DNSSEC to bind synchronization process, decided to purge the key files 1 hour later because it was supposedly deleted. Then, of course, because the key files were missing, bind couldn't process dynamic updates anymore. And that caused that the zone file was not signed at this moment. And we also had a bind private record bug, but we just discovered that 2 months later because we had we were so focused on other problems, mainly HSM problem, then we just discovered that later. Next slide, please. After that first outage, we thought everything was under control, but with DNSSEC, you have some surprise. And so in February, this should have been a boring key deletion operation, but we had unexpected behavior from a bind private record usage. This record is called the type 65534. And in fact, it is used to give the state of a signing process. Perhaps you have never seen this record before if you don't use automatic signing, because it's only used in this specific case. But it's a very important record you have to take into account if you use that functionality from bind. And what was expected from our point of view, and of course in less than the blink of an eye, after the deletion of the key, the DNS key resource record corresponding to the deleted key needed to be removed, and the DNS key resource record set signature needed to be updated. Of course, serial should be incremented, and after this incrementation, SOA signature had to be updated. But unfortunately, there was a bug in bind, but of course, it has been patched since, very fast indeed. And that bug led to a bad signature on Apex N63 record. And at this moment, so FR zone became inaccessible to any validating resolvers. In fact, this was not the first time we had this problem, but it occurred on small zones, because we have the FR zone which is very big and the other zone is very small, but it was visible for less than a second, but with a bigger zone, it lasts hours. So, of course, it's more visible.
Next slide, please.
The third, and perhaps we hope, the last DNSSEC outage was in March. Of course, after the second problem we had, we were working to find a solution, but we didn't have time to put this solution in place. And unfortunately, we had another problem, and it doesn't happen during a period where people were in the office, so it was not very easy to handle with it. So in the morning, in fact, there were key state transitions on zone FR, it worked. Following dynamic updates were well processed. Then, bind decided to modify its private records we have just talked about. But at the same time, unfortunately, again, we had a HSM reachability issue, and the published zone was not correct. And a new type 65534 record has been added to the corresponding resource record set. SOL resource record has been modified as expected, but two signatures were missing. the one for the this private record and the one for the SOA record. There is already a patch, of course, and it has been applied since. So the slide is not up to date. Is signature missing for SOA a big problem? Not really. But it could be worse. And of course, it went worse because we have two NSD name servers amongst our slaves. And in this very special case, NSD did something unexpected. And the behavior was the same on the two name servers. It also decided to remove all signatures of the Apex, which is, in this case, very bad. And there is already a patch. And that what we discover with DNSSEC is there are bugs everywhere, but the patch arrives very fast. Next slide, please. We would like to thank the community because when we had these problems, our monitoring system failed. Now it's better because we have improved our system, but when we launched DNSSEC, we didn't check NSSEC3 resource record, and the first alerts came from people. Perhaps there are some people in this room that send us email, call us to tell us everything is broken. Please do something. And the problem was, those of you who already use validating resolvers were not able to send us emails, of course. In this case, we discover that social networking is a very good mean to communicate between registry and the community. And we received a lot of tweets and direct phone calls. To help us, ISC provided a patch very fast. And as I told you, we also found the bug in Unbound. And the patch has been published. In fact, we found the bug in Bind, Unbound, NSD, and lots of DNSSEC tools. We also had good feedback on our search for a zone verification tool. For instance, LDNS was really promising, but why not fast enough? It's not very easy to find a tool able to deal with a medium-sized zone. The last tool we found was ValidDNS. While very young and still under development, it was able to deal with zones with millions of entries very, very fast. So it's perhaps the tool that we are going to adopt in the next week. Next slide, please. And what happened after this outages? There will be other issues. Unfortunately, we are pretty sure there will be other bugs and problems, and even if we patch tools. Just after ORC and ICANN meeting, not this one, but the last one, we had crisis meeting to decide if we should remove AFNIC CCTLD's DS from the root, because it was not the good situation with all of these problems. And some of us wanted to keep the key in the root zone. Some of us didn't want, so it was a very difficult discussion. But it was decided that we would keep DS if we could finish the implementation of our proxy and deploy it within the next 2 weeks, because we were already working on a solution to avoid the zone file to be spread if there is a problem in it. It was not deployed when we had the last problem, but it was almost finished. It was also decided to postpone the implementation of the service for inserting DS record into the AFNIC zones, which was the next step of our DNSSEC project. We have also modified our system to have a better control over zone changes. And now the zone is validated before it is sent to our hidden name server. And the new notified proxy server controls this. And eventually, we launched our DNS secure version of Zone Check, which is our technical check-in tool, as well as a new version of EPP Server. Our proxy server, I call it our proxy server because it's all, but I know there are lots of people working on such a solution. The first objective of our proxy server is to coordinate all different DNS publication processes, which are mainly dynamic updates, key management, complete zone file generation, the proxy itself, zone file transfer between internal name server and hidden primary name server, and other things. This prevents, for instance, a bind from modifying private records during other DNS processes. The second objective is to add a validation step in this proxy. In fact, there are, from our point of view, mainly two ways for that. You can do a complete zone DNSSEC validation. It's a long-term plan. It's not fully implemented yet, but it should be in the next week. Or you can just check Apex records and some specific ones. And we noticed it would have been enough to detect the outages we had if we just had to check some specific records. And if there is a problem, the proxy stops the publication system and prevents the transfer to our hidden primary name server. So we test it, and with this system, if we have new problems, the zone file could stay on our private server and should not reach the hidden primary name server. The next steps on these tools are we need to automatize recovery system, because now when it's not fully documented, it's really there is only one people that knows how it works, and it's me. And okay, I have to document it and explain to our team how to do if it's broken. And we need to integrate the zone file revision system in the proxy. Next slide, please. I don't have time for that, but it's mainly how our system works, with lots of the different servers that do a publication. And the proxy, as you can see, at the right of the scheme, it receives notification from our hidden name server, then checks our validation are done, and if it's correct, it resends notification to the public name server, and then the transfer can begin when everything is correct. And if there is a mistake, of course, the transfer is not done. Next slide, please. What we have learned with these problems, the main one is regarding different aspects. DNSSEC is still young. It was still possible to find bugs in the most common DNSSEC tools, bind, unbound, NSD, etc. But the good point is that these tools are patched very fast. We also learned that Teams training is essential, and when you master DNS, it doesn't mean you'll deal with DNSSEC easily. And DNSSEC specialists are still mandatory when problems occur, and we also discovered that there are few field-proven tools available, And zone size is often a problem with that tools. You should keep all zone file revisions to find bug. But if you are in the same case than us with a dynamic update and automatic signing, it's not that obvious to keep all zone file revisions. But hopefully we have deployed a zone revision system just a few times before the issues, and we just missed a version of the zone. Of course, you need to monitor and monitor and monitor again. We didn't monitor enough, but now perhaps it's not enough, but we monitor more than before, and we hope that we will find very fast if there is a new problem. And something very important, it's not technical, but we discover that it's very important to provide as fast as possible completely transparent information to our community. It was much appreciated. And all details of for each outage is published on our public website, and it's still available. And the good news with that is that we are not alone.
Next slide, thank you.
And when we had our problems, RIPE also had issues with DNSSEC, and we started not only with RIPE, but also with guys from NLNet Labs, DNIC, etc. First discussion about the need of a DNSSEC verification tool on ORC mailing list started. And with other interested parties in this topic, a first meeting was held to gather first requirement during ORC meeting. And there was also an informal meeting during IETF 18. Discussions are still in progress. If you are interested, you can join the mailing list. It is hosted by the NLNet Net Labs. It's not very active at the moment. There are not a lot of emails, but people are working on tools and etc. So if you have some requests, if you are interested by some options, please join us and tell us what you are looking for, etc. And it's over.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for sharing those experiences. We really appreciate that. It's very helpful for the community to hear and such a forthright description and good details of what happened. Wonderful. Thank you. Now we'll go on to Peter Loescher, going to tell us about some of the ISC experiences.
Hi. This will be slightly a more more operational and a little bit less technical presentation. This presentation has been given at some of the operational conferences like NANOG, and as well as the DNS OARC conferences. So some of you may have actually seen this before, but this is called DNSSEC in the Glue, an Operational Tale. Next slide. So the network impact of DNSSEC, it means that now signed DNS responses are big, and we'll show you a little example at the next slide, because they now have DS, NSSEC, NSSEC3, DNS key, and RRSIG data, which means that they dramatically increase query size responses. And because it means that 512-byte UDP packets just don't cut it. So if you thought that DNS was still just 512 bytes UDP, you're sadly mistaken. And that eDNS0 is no longer nice to have. Next slide. So just how much bigger? So on the left, or basically there are two responses from DIG. And without DNSSEC, you get the typical, you get just your IP address back. And as you see in the red, down at the bottom, the received, it's 320 bytes. This is the DNS responses that we all know and love. Now, with DNSSEC, things get just a little bit more complicated. So you get the A record, and then you get this lovely RR signature response. And for the sake of brevity, we kind of removed most of it. And if you look at the bottom, the received size was just over 1,600 bytes. So we're talking a non-trivial times figure of response size. So next slide. So some of you may know this, some of you may not. We actually operate a secondary name service now. We run it for both public benefit, and we also run a commercial platform. Our commercial platform has three Anycast clouds with multiple providers. We do IPv6, and we're fully DNSSEC capable. So next slide. We host a large multinational internet property on our commercial service. I can't necessarily say who they are, but I can basically hint that it's a small subsidiary of eBay. Their zones were not signed. And when they went live with us, some users couldn't successfully resolve records in that domain. Now, with ISC, what we do is we're big DNSSEC proponents. So, of course, we all sign all of our zones from ISC.org to the zones that comprise our SNS service. So the zone of the content provider were not signed. They are planning to do DNSSEC in the future, sometime before the end of the year, but at the time of their migration to SNS, they weren't signing their zones. But they also, when they look up the name servers for their delegation, of course, the NS records for the zone were referencing records that were in a signed zone. So in our particular case, for an example, we have isc-sns.com.net/info. And so you'd see the delegation for this particular domain and see the NS records pointing to these sites. And so when they do the then lookup for the glue, they find that the responses coming back are, yes, here's the A record or quad A record for the DNS server, and then, oh, here's a whole bunch of RR6s with it to boot. So the resulting responses popped above the 512-byte limit, and we're back at the same behavior as the simple case that I showed earlier. Next slide. So another issue that cropped up was that periodically the signing keys, either the KSK or more often the ZSK, should be changed. So during the period when any server could be passing out the old key, both the old and the new keys are included in responses. So yet again, the responses then just got bigger. This mostly impacts spaces where EDNS0 is enabled, but a conservative, often less than 1K limit, is chosen. Now, in this particular case, the large internet property has lots and lots of customers, and they have lots and lots of customers who depend on the resolution to make their financial transactions. So suffice to say, if you can't resolve this particular domain, people get grumpy, and people get grumpy very, very quickly. But it's also the case of, with a lot of these customers, it was basically someone who was designing a website, say, 3-5 years ago. They used their provider, or they set up DNS, and they just stuck it in the corner and completely forgot about it. So it was, maybe it's behind a Cisco PIX, or sat behind a firewall, where best common practices 5 years ago was basically filter anything larger than 512 bytes, and don't support EDNS0. So we were running into a lot of cases, and we were working with the company at the time to try to educate their users, was that, no, times have changed. There's this thing called DNSSEC. There's this support for EDNS0 that you should that you should really support, and you should stop dropping packets that are, say, larger than 512 or 1K. So there was this one issue with when we first started loading this or started serving the data where people couldn't resolve because of, say, the 512K limit. So everybody raised it to 1 or 2K. Then we sort of got the double whammy when we did the key rollover. Since we had double sets of RRSIGs, that increased it to over 2K. So we were hitting yet another breach, and we'd get some of the same people going, well, you told us. And I said, and we basically, at least from ISC's perspective, we're telling them that, no, just don't filter. Allow up to 4K of your responses, then you won't have a problem. Don't block fragments. Don't block eDNS0 and allow TCP. That was another issue that came up. Some of these folks were just dropping TCP responses altogether. So it's one of these cases, especially, as I say, we now offer secondary name service where we actually got frontline experience with actual customers, as in customers on the ground, because ISC normally we deal with vendors and interface with vendors, and the vendors deal with customers. So it gave us it gave us a different perspective on sort of the DNSSEC issues on the ground. Next slide. But really, I don't have a problem, really. So the DNSSORG folks have a service where you can give it a dig query, and it'll tell you the largest response size that that it will allow on your local resolver. So the first example is when it works, you basically give it a query against rs.dns-org.net, and it will run through it the iterations and give you an answer back. In this particular case, we were able to send the largest eDNS size. When it doesn't, you'll get a response that says the largest response that we were able to give was 512, so we lack eDNS support. And some of the answers may be in between. You may only allow 2K. So this is a quick way to look. A lot of times, it's still the case where if you're on a hotel network, if you're not getting captured already, a lot of the hotel networks are still, you can still find many of them that still don't support eDNS0 yet. So, it's pretty interesting to see where failures do happen. But more and more, you are starting to see eDNS0 support being rolled out. Next. So, Bind, I'm sure many of you already know this, but just a quick recap. We've been doing eDNS0 since Bind 8. In particular, 830. We got DNSSEC bis in 930. But we know that there are known flaws for anything before 94 ESB. And it's highly recommended that you run 97. Actually, this slide is slightly out of date. 973 now. And 96 is actually close to hitting end of life. So, next slide. Note that we also have 98 out there as well. So some of the key takeaways. Make sure all your network elements are that touch DNS can do eDNS0 and allow 4K responses. And I would also add to that, allow TCP on port 53. Make sure that any network security elements allow IP fragments. Use the OARC reply slice tester to validate your systems and to identify customer problems. And educate your customer base. I would like to reiterate that, and while I can't use their name, they were very, very helpful in sort of dealing with the problem, because we could have gone to, say, stop signing one of our names in the glue to allow some responses to go back under 512. But actually, after talking to them, they said, no. Please continue to do what you're doing. It's basically educating the customer base to allow us to make it easier for us to roll out DNSSEC later this year. So you're basically helping us find the dead wood, so to speak, and the people we'd have to interact with anyway. So they might as well learn now. So we're rather taken aback by that, actually, and really appreciated their upfrontness in regards to that. So, but they had actually now have an internal document that they give to their customers that basically explain all this in more detail and say, these are the things that you need to do to support this, because if you're not getting nailed by it now, you will be nailed by it later this year when we start signing our zones. Next slide. So references, for those, you already know what DNSSEC is, so and there's the URL for the reply size tester. You can also get to it, I believe, from the DNSSEC main website or main page, as well as obviously the links for Bind. And that should be it.
Great. Thank you, Peter. And let me give all our panelists a round of applause here. We have our one more presentation that's actually a video presentation, but since we've actually run a little bit long on the presentations in the room, what I think we're going to do is open the floor for questions so we have sufficient time for discussion and questions here. And then while we have the lunch being served, we're going to go ahead and play Roland's video. Since he isn't around for interaction anyway, we can let folks watch it and see it during the mealtime. So time to open the floor for questions. And I see a couple people coming to the mic. Who's going to get there first?
Bill Manning preempting Richard Lamb. I'm getting good at this. Peter, I gave a talk similar to that, the one you just gave a couple of years ago in Bangkok, and one of the things we were seeing is intermittent packet sizes, response sizes, that went above 4K. That was 2 years ago. And that really drives the need to go to TCP. Are you seeing that?
We haven't seen that yet, at least in the wild. I mean, you can obviously pack, and we know some people who do pack their DNS responses with like 4 or 5 keys, which could, in theory, bump up to above 4K. So if you've got, say, backup of ZSKs and KSKs, and you're running with 2 or 3 or 4 sets of RRSIGs, that could bump it up. I think from our perspective, we ran 2 or 3 RRSIGs, and we were getting pretty close to 4K, but we didn't go above it. But we haven't seen it in the wild other than ourselves.
Okay, yeah. The reason we saw them was where people were using multiple algorithms.
Oh, okay.
Okay, this is a question or comment to the IFR gentleman. First, I want to applaud once again the transparency in which you described the issues you guys experienced. And my main question is, can you tell me what the network problems were with the AEP keepers? Being someone who actually has a number of them in use, I would be really interested to hear anything about that, if you could say something.
Do I sense a degree of concern?
Not really, just interest.
No. In terms of transparency, I can tell you everything. But don't worry, the problem was not a HSM problem. It was not the box itself. It was because it was to a new equipment, and we had some problem with our procedures and etc. People made mistakes, and but it was a network problem.
It's a relatively old design, and so I was.
Yes, but the HSM, we have no real problem with the HSM itself.
I'd like to ask a question with respect to complexity of the systems, and it's I'm not sure whether or not we've seen some of the behind the scenes structure of what JPRS did in signing theirs, but in the AFNIC case, you laid out the structure with the proxies and the HFSMs and so forth. Was there a trade-off analysis of some sort done for instance, how many different devices and boxes, whether they're computers or HSMs, versus and the risk of having the multiples and the connectivity versus a consolidation on a smaller number? Was that part of the considerations of your design?
To be honest, when we started the project, we didn't imagine there was so different boxes, and we didn't spend enough time on this part. And that's why we had this proxy to do the synchronization between these different boxes, different applications, etc., etc., to be sure everything is under control. Because sometimes you have unexpected behavior from a box or applications, and you need to control this. But the study of this part was, I guess, a little too small at the beginning of the project. But now we guess it's better, and it should interact better now with this new architecture.
Thank you.
Patrick Feldstrom with my Cisco hat on. You talk about fragmented packets and fragmented UDP packets, etc., and large responses. And you talked about it in a way which implied that you do not see any problems with fragmented UDP packets in your deployment. For example, two specific problems that I hear people claim is happening in the world, and the reason why I bring it up is that I have been looking for people that really have data on these problems, and I cannot find them. People just talk about them being problems. One of them has to do with denial of service attacks using UDP fragments, where the first fragment is like constructed attacks with like fragments except the first one. The second one, and that is actually one ISP in Europe has actually blocking UDP fragments in their network because rumors that there are a lot of DDoS attacks using UDP fragments. And I would like to get more data about that if someone has that. So far, no one has contacted me. The other one has to do with a lot of packet reordering issues together with UDP fragments. I have found one such case which I thought had to do with Cisco equipment, actually, but it was actually a bad network design that led to the reordering. So that I actually have one case of, but I would like to see more of those things. So if people actually see issues with fragmented packets and DNS specifically in UDP, please let me know.
One thing that, because I come from the system architecture side, in regards to fragmented UDP, is that some implementations and some OSs and some firewalls on them to do the IP fragmentation, you have to basically allow all-to-all frag or fragments. And so you have to, in theory, basically allow anything that has a fragment tag because either the firewall layer happens before packet reassembly or and similar actions. So I can see where some people think that it could perhaps be a attack vector because you can, in theory, send a fully formed packet and just tack it with frag, and then it hits the first rule set or hits the allow fragment rule set, and then you're screwed. So, we're always definitely interested when it comes to DDoS attack vectors, especially for DNS. So, along with Patrick, ISC would also be interested in any such data.
So I don't see any in the chat room, so I'm going to go to our topics that are on the screen. And these are broad topics, but intended to address, from your experiences, what you see as, you know, the most important aspects to worry about, to get right, and so forth. So the first ones, are there any particular things, whether it's, you know, documentation, training, software, tools, et cetera, that now in retrospect, after you've gone through what you've gone through, it would have been good to have at the beginning?
I guess there was nothing important missing, but we had to train our team. It was the most important thing. That's why when we started the project, the first thing we did was to go to ISC and to have a very good training. And that was very helpful for us to start the project and to understand everything about DNSSEC, because even if you read RFCs and if you use tools, it's not enough. So training is really, from my point of view, the most important thing with DNSSEC. And the people who implement the solution in the registry need to be trained, but also the people that do the work every day. And that's an aspect that is not completely finished, because everybody in our company is not completely aware of DNSSEC things. And it's, I guess, the most important thing.
From ISC's perspective, this whole exercise was very instructive for us because, as I said before, we're mostly a vendor, a sort of back-end vendor, so to speak. So we've never really dealt a lot with the, say, the general public to a certain extent. So things like documentation or end-user documentation, other than to sort of other people in sort of trained toward geeks, so to speak. As I said, this particular internet property has a lot of end-users, and end-users who aren't necessarily, say, Linux or Unix literate. They basically write their web pages and the latest technology of the day, whether it's PHP or they do a Drupal website for their e-commerce, and DNS is just the back-end thing that the ISP or the hosting provider actually manages. So part of it was sort of educating the consumer or educating the end user for this property about sort of basic DNS to a certain extent. And we actually worked with our customer to basically say, here's some of the things you can do. Here are some things you can do to instruct them on how to better support these larger DNS responses. The other thing is that we rolled out we pointed folks to the DNS reply size tester to basically tell them, see, you do have a problem. Well, for a lot of these people, they don't even have access to a Unix shell to actually run Dig. So one of the things that we've talked about, and we all actually talked to Ripe about this, is they had a reply size tester in Java that was just a Java applet. It was basically written to sort of prepare people for the root signing, so to make sure that they can see the larger responses from the root. And that's actually something that's probably a little bit more end-user friendly for someone to just click on a web page and run the test rather than have access to a shell to run. And even if they have access to a shell, do they have Dig? So that was like, yeah, I guess there is the rest of the world other than sort of the Unix, the Linux side. So that's what I would say, basically documentation and sort of tools that sort of represent sort of a larger customer base that's sort of outside the sort of geek technical community.
In Japanese case, very important things is native language documentation and native language training. So currently, we need, I think we need DNSSEC tools document in Japanese.
So the language issue for all aspects was the major thing that would have been helpful to begin with. I'd like to ask a little bit more in the training area for the AFRINEC. What type of training? Is it training in what DNSSEC is? Is it training in how do you operate a signing system? Is it training, you know, what types of training is it that you
require? It's not really a training about what DNSSEC is, because, of course, we operate DNS every day, so we know what DNSSEC is. But it's completely different from the theoretical aspect to the practical one. And when you operate DNSSEC, there are some tricky situations. And the training we needed were training about operation. It was not really about DNSSEC. And that's why I told you the perhaps there are other people doing DNSSEC training, but the one provided by IEC was really focused on the tool we use. And that's why we chose this one, because we use BIND. And it was really focused on operational thing, and it was very important for us. Even if we didn't use everything we learned, because we still use OpenDNSSEC, for instance, which is completely different. We have a mix of BIND and OpenDNSSEC things, but it was really focused on operational thing, and it was very important for us.
Thank you. So I guess I'd like to jump to question number three, and three seemed like a good number to ask for the three most important things that you would recommend for others that are going forth to do DNSSEC, that they think about, examine carefully, and if you will, they need to pay the most attention to getting it right to ease their implementation in DNSSEC. Can we start with Fujiwari-san this time? So question number three, what are the... I picked three. One or two is an okay number to give. But the most important thing that people should think about before they start the process to get right, so it'll be easier to get it right.
First, people know... problems without DNSSEC. For example, Kaminsky method, and then easy tools, easy signing tools existence, and easy troubleshooting tools, I think.
Okay, so the first thing, of course, is training, as I already told you, but if you had something very important to do, is perhaps do the things in the correct order, because when we wrote the proxy server, perhaps it was too late. We should have start with that part of the system to prevent us from produce unvalidating zone file. And perhaps it's the first thing to do, to have a mechanism to validate and to check if the DNSSEC stuff is correct on your zone file before you spread it on the internet. And I guess it's one of the most important things with the training. And perhaps you could try to do something easier than what we do. And perhaps that's the combination between NSEC 3, opt-out, dynamic update, and automatic signing is not the easiest one.
Well, I might actually slightly merge 3 and 4 together to a certain extent, because I think the three most important things that you can that I could recommend to DNSSEC deployers is educate, educate, educate. especially if you're handling end users or basically not basically folks who may not be technically, at least with DNS, technically aware of DNS other than it handling in the background. Put up documentation that says we are making this change. What DNSSEC is, I think if you even want to, if I'm sure that at some point the skit of the DNSSEC for beginners that we did on Monday will be up and link to that to sort of give people an idea of what it's actually all about and how they can and what they may see because of it. Oh, you may not be able to resolve your website because of some intermediate issue resolving because of the packets are too big. I mean, obviously try to keep the document or try to keep the technical jargon to a slight minimum, but educate that there is a change coming and how they can sort of try to prepare themselves for it and giving them the tools to see if they're going to be affected and what they can do to actually remedy the situation. And barring that, you can do all the education you want, but there are still people who won't notice it until it actually breaks, and then have something in there in place to help instruct them, either bulk up your help desk or train your help desk to be able to take care of these issues. Because what we found in our particular case was that a lot of these providers, if they were running Bind, they were still running like Bind 9.3. So it's really one of those cases with DNS, especially in the enterprise community. You basically set it up, and then you stick it in a corner, and then you don't think about it until it breaks. So it's like, geez, 9.3, there are like how many security vulnerabilities and how many performance issues and so forth. So if there was one thing I had to take away, it would just be educate, because especially if you're dealing with e-commerce where on-time reliability is almost a must, the customers will scream and scream loudly back at you if everything's not running smoothly.
Okay, well, thank you. I think that I'm going to offer one more call for questions from the floor or the chat room. And unless we have some there, please come to the mic if you do have some. Ah, okay, good.
Hello, Lars Lehmann from NetNode again. I support what you said. Getting to know the stuff is the most important thing. But I didn't hear any one of you mentioning maintain a good relationship with your slave operators. Things like DNSSEC timers and could expire times and all that may have a large impact on the operations with the slave server system. So make sure that you're in sync with your slave server operators before you deploy this.
Okay, Anton Sures again. One of the things I want to add is that one of the things we saw that there was documentation for HSMs is very poor. I don't know if you have any other experiences. I'm glad to hear about it. The second thing I wanted to mention is that what we see now when I'm looking into the future is that the speed of signing might be an issue when you have an operational issue and you need to sign your complete zone, and it's a large zone, then it might become unavailable for a longer period of time than what you do when you don't have DNSSEC. And that's something that worries me, because I think that signers need to be faster. So I don't know if anyone's coming out.
Yes, you're right, but at the moment we sign a very few number of records, and we hope that in 10 days, 10 years, when people will send us more DS, there will be more powerful HSMs. But for the moment, you are right. If we should sign the war zone, it would be an issue.
That's the goal, right? Everything signed.
Yes, but with NSX3, you don't sign a lot of things.
So
So my besides the point raised by Lars Lehmann, there is the concern about mixing transport families. If you have some places that are native IPv6, some places that go through V6 tunneling, you end up with path MTU issues which affect your ability to actually move packets. And that, the ability to look into the infrastructure to help that debugging, that's the part of the educational process, is critical, particularly since we're transitioning between V4 and V6.
I agree. I think tunnels should die, but I realize that they're also a necessary evil at this point. But we haven't seen that so much for us, because most everyone is still using V4, but I believe that will become an issue over time as people enable V6, and they may not be able to make immediately the jump to, say, native V6 transit. But, yeah, PathMTU, the bane of my existence to a certain extent.
Okay, do we have any more questions or comments from the floor or the chat room? Okay, so in that case, I think we'll go ahead to Roland's video, and we'll ask Julie to go ahead and make the change here.
Yeah, I'll switch over, and at some point during the video, I think lunch will be ready, so we'll probably just, as soon as I see that it's ready, it's not quite yet, we'll let you know that you can head back there. So let me get the video started.
While she's doing that, let me ask to everybody give a nice round of applause to our panelists again. Thank them.
Curiosity, and I read it, and it said that, well, there are very few rewards for enterprises to actually run DNSSEC because nobody is doing validation. And I thought,
is that really true? Where did they get the information? So I dove a little deeper into the subject and found out that actually there is no data available and nobody knows who is doing validation. Earlier this year in March, the Japan Registry Services did a presentation on how to count DNS validators. And what they've been doing is they've been looking at offline data that they had collected on their authoritative name servers.
The link on the slide tells you where you can find the report that they presented at the DNS OARC workshop. Now, we had already started on this very similar effort, but instead of working with offline data like JPRS did, we focused on doing this with live data from our authoritative name servers. Now, our strategy with this research was that we assume that only validating resolvers will send queries for DS records and DNS key records, because if they want to validate our data, they will need our DNS key records, and if they want to validate subdomains, they need the DS records that are available in our domains. Now, what we did was we implemented some simple tools that we based on libpcap that capture and parse DNS packets. And these tools send that data off to a big server which has a database that aggregates the data, and we specifically filter out queries for our signed domains only so that we get representative data on DNSSEC validation. Now I can show you some early results of the work that we've done, and I hope you can all see this on the slide. I hope the video encoder does his job well and shows you this in HD quality. And what you can see on the slide here is a map of Europe with some dots in every country that have a color. And the color varies according to the number of validating resolvers that we have detected in this geographic area. As an example, you can see a text balloon above the Netherlands that says that there is a total number of resolvers that was 24,000, of which we have detected DNSSEC use at 135, which means that about 0.5% of all the resolvers that we saw in the Netherlands for both the Surfnet.nl and Gigaport.nl domains supports DNSSEC validation. And that's actually not a bad score. It was more than I expected. I expected something like 0.1%. What you can also see is that countries that have been doing DNSSEC for a little bit longer than the Netherlands score better on this chart. I hope you can see that the Czech Republic, and let me just see if I can move my mouse cursor, the Czech Republic, which is here in the middle of the picture, has a purple anchor point in it, and that means that over 1% of DNS resolvers does DNSSEC validation. And the same is true for Sweden, which is at the top of the map, just above the Netherlands text balloon. Now, we also have a different map which shows you in colors what the amount of validating resolvers is in a country. And the more towards purple the color is, the more validators there are as a percentage of the total number of resolvers that we have detected. So again, you can see that countries like Sweden, Finland, and the Czech Republic, which have been doing DNSSEC for quite some time, score better on this chart. And of course, there are also some anomalies in there. As you can see, Madagascar is also purple. And the reason for this is that we see very few resolvers actually sending queries for our domains from Madagascar. So if one of them does DNSSEC validation, that will show up as a bit of a bias in the results. We also have tables that show the results. And here you can see highlighted in gray, again, the Netherlands with 24,000 resolvers in total, 135 of which are sending out DNS key or DS queries. So we think that they are DNSSEC validators, and that is 0.56% of the total number of resolvers that are out there. What you can also see in the lower table is if you click on the Netherlands, for instance, in the table above, you get an overview of all the resolvers that we have detected, and we split them out by ISP block. So what you can see is that there are some resolvers in there for Surfnet, and there is one for a technical university, and there is also one for a large internet provider or a large mobile internet provider, which is T-Mobile. And in fact, we know that T-Mobile does DNSSEC validation. Now, what do we plan to do with this tooling? Well, what we intend to do is make the information that we gather using this tool available to those who are interested. We're not going to be publishing it on a public site yet because we feel that there may be some privacy-sensitive data in there. So we are considering whether or not to publicly make this data available. But if you're interested, you can contact me and I can make it available to you. We're also talking to SIDN, the .nl top-level registry, to see if we can run these probes on their .nl infrastructure. Because, of course, the data for Surfnet.nl is interesting for us, but it is not very representative because it is logical that universities abroad or research networks abroad will be more interested in the Surfnet.nl domain than regular internet users, which may show up as a bias in the result. Whereas .nl is a domain that is queried all over the world and not just from academic institutions. We are going to release all the tools that we created under a BSD license. In fact, the probe software that runs on the authoritative name server is already available. And if you want to access the source code, please let me know because I can make it available to you from a Subversion repository. Also, if you're interested in contributing to this work, please let me know. My contact details will be shown on the last slide at the end of this presentation. Now, a second issue that I would like to discuss with you is UDP fragmentation issues. The reason I want to discuss this is because we have run into trouble with this since we have signed our domain. Now, some of you may know that we signed the surfnet.nl domain end of last year and published the DS record in the .nl zone. And we started experiencing problems with a large ISP in November. We had just had our DS published in the .nl zone, and some of my colleagues came to me and they started complaining that they couldn't access their email from their home DSL connection. And we did some logging, and as it turned out, one of the firewalls at the ISP was discarding UDP fragments. Now, if you have a large DNSSEC answer that is being sent back, that will get fragmented. So if the UDP fragments get discarded, the answer never reaches the original resolver. And even though the ISP was not actually doing DNSSEC validation, they were still sending out DNSSEC queries. We talked to their engineers, and it turned out that they couldn't replace this firewall because it had been there for years. Nobody knew who set it up. Nobody knew exactly what the configuration was like, and they didn't dare touch it just before Christmas. So what they ended up doing was reconfiguring their resolvers, which are actually running unbound from Anelnet Labs. And they reconfigured them to send out a smaller eDNS buffer size, which they set to 512 bytes. And that solved the issue, because whenever they request something that is larger than 512 bytes, then we would get a TCP fallback. So problem solved, right? Well, it turned out the problem wasn't solved, because early this year, actually in March, we suddenly started getting complaints from companies who were trying to send us email. And lo and behold, we did some research, and it turned out that they were customers of this same ISP that we had had issues with before. And the screenshot that you can see from the email client actually shows you the error that they got, which is basically that the mail they were sending us couldn't be delivered. As it turned out, the firewall strikes back, because these customers of the ISP all were using their MS Exchange service. They have a managed Microsoft Exchange service, which they can use to run their corporate email. And it turned out that they were all using this. And we called the engineers at the ISP again and said, hey, we're experiencing issues again. Have you changed something? And they started delving into the problem. And as it turned out, they had recently upgraded their dedicated resolvers that they were using for this hosted exchange environment. And they had upgraded them to Windows 2008 Release 2, which supports eDNS 0 and sets the DO bit to 1, which means it's sending out DNSSEC queries even though it doesn't do validation. And again, the firewall was stopping UDP fragments from getting back to their resolvers, which meant that they couldn't resolve our MX records and they couldn't send us email. And the solution to this was to tweak an arcane registry setting somewhere deep in Windows, which disabled eDNS 0, and the problem was solved. Now, of course, this is a very severe issue, because there was very little that we could do about this, because we could change the setting for eDNS 0 on our authoritative name servers, but that would mean we are putting a penalty on 99.9% of the people who are doing it right. So this was a bit of a conundrum. And while we were investigating this issue, we actually discovered something interesting. The resolvers behind the firewall received the first fragment of the UDP packet. We could actually see the first fragment going through the firewall, arriving at the resolver. And we could see that two fragments had been sent from the authoritative name server, so one fragment was being stopped. And actually, the protocol stack on the resolver detects this, and it sends back an ICMP message, which wasn't being blocked by the firewall, and actually got back to our authoritative name servers. And this ICMP message tells us that, hey, I got a first fragment, but I didn't receive the rest of the fragment, so I couldn't reassemble the packet. So it says, as you can see in the screenshot, ICMP IP reassembly time exceeded. And we could actually see the size of the fragment that they were missing. So what we determined from this is that we can actually detect resolvers that have this issue. So what we are doing is we are extending our monitoring tools to detect this issue, and we're going to log this in the database to see the extent of this problem on the internet. And we did some initial packet dumping, and that was actually quite scary because we saw these ICMP fragment reassembly failed messages coming back every once in a while, maybe every 1 or 2 seconds, which is actually quite frequent. And another issue is that people seem to think that UDP fragments are some form of attack. Now, maybe that was true 10 or 15 years ago when there were all these packet of death methods that you could use to crash Windows 95 computers and Linux computers that had faulty TCP and UDP implementations, but it isn't an issue anymore, we believe. But still, there are people out there who think that this is an attack, and we actually had abuse complaints sent to our cert team, which said, hey, your NS1, NS2, NS3.servnet.nl are trying to flood our servers with UDP fragments, so we believe you are attacking us. And it turned out that they were sending DO equals 1 queries to our servers, so they were getting back a DNSSEC answer, which was larger than the MTU size and meant that they were getting fragmented packets. So it was perfectly valid internet traffic that they were marking as an attack. And once we'd explained the problem to them, they conceded that this wasn't actually an attack and they fixed it in their firewall. And this was actually a large university in Canada that was reporting this. So these are people that should have known better. Now what we are doing is we have a student who is actually creating a lab setup so that we can verify that our assumption that these ICMP messages are being returned whenever this issue occurs is valid. And once we have confirmed that this theory is actually sound, we will try to publish a paper about this. Now, the conclusion I would like to draw is that this is an issue that requires serious attention, right? It really affected us. People couldn't send us email. My colleagues couldn't contact our servers from their home DSL connection because this issue occurred. And there is very little that you can do about this if you have a signed domain. Now, I have some ideas about how you could make authoritative servers a little bit more resilient. You could detect ICMP return packets getting back to your authoritative server and then for the time being mark this server as not supporting larger packets and limit the size of the data that you send to them. But I guess that if I would propose this in an IETF working group, I would be severely flamed. But then again, I believe that it would make internet traffic somewhat more resilient, so I think that we should start a discussion about whether or not this has merit. And if you operate a signed zone, you may actually want to do some TCP dumping and see if you see this issue. Because if it is occurring, you may want to take measures to prevent it. Now, that is all I want to discuss with you today. I think I've managed to stay within my 15 minutes. If you have any questions about this presentation, please feel free to contact me. My email address is on the slide, as well as my Twitter account. Thank you for your attention.
There you go ahead.
Well, this was very good. Roland was not able to join us, but was willing to contribute this way, and I think it's excellent because we also, the video is posted on the workshop page, as well as all of the slides, and I apologize for not pointing that out earlier. If anyone, especially the folks listening online, want to see the slides a little bit better, just go ahead to the workshop page, and all the slides are there in PDF, and you can go ahead and download them. Well, I believe our lunch is ready. And Julie has got our sponsors back up, so let me turn it over to her.
Yes, please help yourself to lunch. There should be plenty of it. And we'll give you a little bit of extra time, I think, since we ran over a little bit. I'll give you a reminder to wrap things up probably at 12:30, and we'll start not too long after that. But please enjoy your lunch. Thank you.